The time is June 30th, 1989, where the film adaptation of the book of the same name, Great Balls of Fire by Mira Lewis and Murray Silver Jr., came to theaters and focuses on the upstart rock and roll singer Jerry Lee Lewis, played by Dennis Quaid, who has just cut a record at Sun Studios. Jerry's cousin, Pastor Jimmy Swaggart, played by a young Alec Baldwin, tries to steer him away from the depraved life of the music business. But Jerry sees his chance to claim the throne of popular music. But his eyebrow-raising love of his 13-year-old, twice-removed cousin, Mira, played by Winona Ryder, may ruin his chances. In a film and story that crescendoed from what Jerry Lee Lewis was famous for that took a turn to what he was later known for. Was the toe-tapping with its questionable simplistic style versus its subject matter good then, and does it hold up now? And above it all, were our critics right? We're about to find out as we cover 1989's Great Balls of Fire.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your host Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of The Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
So last week, Antonio, I know you kind of gave me little hints of your thoughts on this movie. So now there is a reason I picked this movie, and it's not the reason I think you think. So when I was a kid, this movie came out when I would think I was 7 or 8. And open and honest, this movie was so simplistic when it comes to its music biopic theme that I was engulfed by it. I love the music, and I think a lot of the young youth really got engulfed in this movie for the wrong reasons. And while I was researching movies to add to our list, I came across the Siskel and Ebert episode, and that was a lineup of some fun films. And I knew you would have killed me if I put Weekend at Bernie's on the list. So it came down to this because I really wanted to see how my opinion has changed from the kid in me that really loved the music of this one to the adult me that criticizes a lot of movies. And this one, for the first time on the show, actually made me do a flip. So this one actually changed my opinion. Now, if this is on late at night and I need to turn my brain off, will I watch it? Absolutely. But that's not saying much when it comes to a movie that really covers the life and controversy of a famous musician. So, and that's where I think lies the problem of what we're going to discuss. But there are a lot of issues that I came up with this movie that really, from the time from 89 till now, really does raise some eyebrows and almost to where our filmmakers decide to focus on in this movie. But I don't know. I've been dying because I think I know where you're going to go with it, but let's just have you cover it at this point.
I mean, so the monster in me wants to just curse your name for bringing this to the list. I mean, you put it on really early when we were planning out episodes, and I knew we were going to get to it eventually. I got to put a little bit of a preface to this. My least favorite genre of film is the musical biopic. I think it is the laziest, most pretentious, and most fake style of filmmaking out there because it either glamorizes someone who is already living a glamorous lifestyle, and then it makes us feel sympathetic for, oh, they were into drugs, or, oh, they were into sex. It's like, okay, most musicians of this level were generally bad people. Why are we glamorizing what they're doing? And this is probably the worst example of what to do with a musical biopic that I think I've ever seen. I avoided this movie for years and years and years. I did not grow up with this movie. My parents hated Jerry Lee Lewis, so I didn't have to worry about it. They were Elvis people, 100%. Which doesn't really make anything better when it comes to, hey, he's a much better person than Jerry Lee Lewis was in real life. I think the music was better. But where I fell into this film was I became a real fan of the director Jim McBride when I was starting to discover more films in my late teens, early 20s. His remake of the French film Breathless with Richard Gere, I thought was just a really, really interesting and stylish American remake of a French classic that people absolutely love or hate. But I like the remake better. I think the original is boring and it's meandering and it's meaningless. And that's not to say I don't like movies like that. I just don't like that particular version. And then The Big Easy. That's like one of my favorite 80s neo-noirs of all time. I mean, when you put that and Johnny Handsome and Body Heat, those three movies really make up that kind of sultry 80s sweaty noir style. So I love what Jim McBride was doing. So when I watched this film for the first time in my late teens, early 20s, I was expecting that Jim McBride. And instead, what we get is just a highly sanitized, candy-coated, glossy, I'm almost going to say amateurishly acted rendition of what Jerry Lee Lewis's life supposedly was. And when we get to the critics' review of it, I agree with one of them so much in the sense that we're going to just cover 2 years of this dude's life from like the start of his success to his downfall. We're not going to give the movie the ending that we want to see of like, where did it fall apart? We're not going to give us the early years of him coming up and the multiple marriages he had before he became famous. No, we're going to show the quintessential two kids watching people play blues and feeling the devil's music, which, I'm sorry, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story did it the best. I'm sorry. But yeah, this movie, man, this is the most angry I've been in this particular podcast. That's where I am with this movie.
After I was done with viewing, and this is one I didn't have multi-watches with because it already kind of ruined my childhood of where I was as an adult, because what really engulfed me in the, as a kid, and it's easy to do as a kid, is a fantastic music, is toe-tapping. It's great. And you don't know the situation. We don't know why people are pissed off at this guy in the movie when you're seven, 8 years old. You just don't understand. So it's easy as a kid. And as an adult, I literally shut it off and took a break. I think it was at the one scene that I will probably talk about numerous times as an example is the sex scene with Winona Ryder and Dennis Quaid, which is really the pivotal moment that you know this movie has absolutely no direction or no idea what it's trying to be, because it goes for simplistic. It tries to be almost, I hate to say it, but family friendly to an extent. But at the same time, it picks and chooses what it wants to show. We won't show the drinking, the cheating. We'll see a 30-second clip of that. But you know what? We'll see a 13-year-old girl lose supposedly her virginity. And that scene lasts the longest out of a lot of these kind of distasteful scenes. And at that point, that you know that really the adaption is almost in control of what is shown on screen. It's almost to an extent that you can see the book and Mira Lewis really controlling what is on screen to an extent, because it is really, like you said, and our critics are going to say, it is really sanitized on what we're showing. It's like pulling the curtain over a man saying, don't see this, let me show you what I want to see. And it's, you get one of those dark moments and then you get a toe tapping song and it really doesn't know where it wants to go. And I hate to keep bringing up the critics, but at the same time, at the, one of them says it loses steam. It loses steam within 45 minutes of this movie. Yeah. It loses steam where it has no idea where to go. It focuses on this relationship, but at the same time, this is a really taboo subject. This was a huge piece of the controversy of Jerry Lee Lewis. And we don't know what he is thinking. We don't know what the two's chemistry are. They do no work on this chemistry. And I don't know if I wanted to see the chemistry at this point between these two, because it's a very touchy subject. Yeah. This could have been a Brave movie, but at the same time, they don't really focus on anything, because at that point in the 80s, nobody wanted to see it.
Well, so you almost hit the nail on the head of what I was thinking of this movie, and that this movie feels neutered. Like, you've got this filmmaker, and it's so funny that last week our episode was on Bad Influence, talking about Curtis Hanson, how he was so good at making adult thrillers and adult erotic dramas. Well, that's what Jim McBride is good at, too. Jim McBride may as well be the Southern Fried version of Curtis Hanson, but he is totally neutered in this one. He is neutered into the fact where the villain of our movie is Alec Baldwin's Jimmy Swaggart, who's only in it at the beginning, middle, and end, and he is supposed to be the one like, oh, why are you being so mean to Jerry Lee? Well, Jerry Lee is the villain of this movie, but you can't have our villain also be the hero. This movie shouldn't have been made, and it shouldn't have been made in this fashion, for sure. It either had to go 100% into the bowels of the depravity of this story, like you said, be brave and leave the theater feeling yucky. I think you feel even yuckier with this movie, the fact that they do try to gloss it up and glamorize it. The musical numbers are really just confetti for this story to make you feel like you're not really sinking into the depths of the depravity of what this character is and what he's doing. And it feels like such a bait and switch because there's a fantastical essence to these musical numbers where it almost feels like you're watching Grease 2, right? Like, people are just breaking out into song in the high school. Everyone seems to know the choreography. So it makes you question, am I watching a real film or am I watching like an entertainment fluff piece? And if I am, why is it about this guy that married his 13-year-old cousin and then blames the world for his downfall because of it? You know, they just don't understand. No, they fucking don't, and neither do I.
Cousin twice removed, Antonio, twice removed. But you mentioned the high school scene. I was going to bring that up because that is another scene where it's so out of character, because you have him playing playing the piano most of the movie, and then you break into this high school that he's lip syncing, and everybody does know the choreography. Right. And that's, again, we don't know what this movie wants to be. And we get into kind of the consequences of this, and I'll give the movie a little bit of credit here is, back in that time, sure, it may have been common for the age. It may have been common to marry your cousin. But at the same time, this movie doesn't represent that. This movie doesn't give us that knowledge. We're supposed to make this opinion out for ourselves. And that's not to justify if it's right or wrong. But at the time that it's given, the biggest mistake this movie and the studios have was basing this off the adaptation of the written by the ex-wife of Jerry Lee Lewis, because it is going to be sanitized. It is going to be a point of view. We had Priscilla last year that showed the ugliness of it, that had some juicy details to it. That was a very intimate piece. But when we get to this, they remained friends. They remained somewhat family going into all the way through the years. You're not going to get a true interpretation of this man from this adaption. And that is where my frustration lies with this, is this is sanitized for a reason, because Myra Lewis didn't want a bad perception. Even when we get into the beating at the end, that is a very hard scene to watch, and it should have been, but it was done so lightly. And then we have him walking into the sunset at the end. Leave his ass. That's how it should have been. And if you're not portraying that this as a negative of this man, there is something wrong with this adaption. There is something wrong with this movie. If you're going to glorify beating of a female, a beating of a pregnant female, and cheating. So this movie is absolutely disgusting.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm glad that we can get on that common ground of the subject matter. Like, this was not a movie that could have been made with a light coat of paint like it tries to. If they were going to make it, they would have had to have made it a real kind of critical piece on this person. But you can't do that when you have the people behind it. I mean, they used all of Jerry Lee Lewis's vocals and original recordings and new recordings for the music, and they credited him at the end as the killer himself. Like, we're actually proud that he performs all these songs in this film about how he was a real, real questionable guy. Like, it contradicts itself, and it makes no sense to me why they would do that unless there's an inside joke that I'm not a part of. But, dude, it gets even worse. I like Dennis Quaid. I like him as an actor. I like him in lots and lots and lots of movies. There's a few performances of his that I'm just like, eh, Dragonheart being one of them. But I just forgot, because I haven't watched this movie since that first time I watched it, how almost borderline comical his performance is. Like, he's trying so hard to be Jerry Lee Lewis that we don't believe that he is Jerry Lee Lewis. I feel like I'm watching a Saturday Night Live sketch. I feel like I'm watching a Jim Carrey performance, because he's always on. Even in his dramatic moments with his little Southern drawl, his eyebrows are always at like top peak manic, as if he's always performing. And maybe if we knew more about the real Jerry Lee Lewis in his normal life, and he was like that, okay, maybe I'll give him some credit. But they don't give us enough insight onto who this guy really is in real life. So instead, what we get is always performing. He is delivering his lines of dialogue and his emotional scenes with the same manic energy that he does when he's performing the songs. He never turns that off. And it's really, really distracting. And on that same note, Winona Ryder, who I love, she has a very uncomfortable baby doll aesthetic throughout this whole movie that she never turns off. Even in the scenes where she is getting beaten, or even in the scenes where she's getting berated by her parents for getting married in secret, she never turns off this innocent baby doll persona, which makes the film even more disgusting. And these are your two leads. The only people that save this movie for me are the supporting characters, right? It's Trey Wilson, who this was his last film, as the record producer. It's Stephen Tobolowsky. It is Mojo Nixon as one of the band members. Like, these guys do it for me. Even Alec Baldwin, to a sense. He's there, he's working, he's got his Southern fried drawl as well, but he's more convincing to me than any of the scenes that Dennis Quaid delivers.
Yeah, I mean, to his credit, Dennis Quaid, to me, worked in the first 20 minutes, maybe. But I think where we really see him falter is when he tries to tackle the dramatic, because he doesn't know how to transition. I played a scene earlier today which we have that scene where he's at the UK airport, where he's being asked questions. And I saw the live real footage of that. And this is where you can really see that the betrayal is way off, because it's
way off.
So overly done. And when it comes to Winona Ryder, this is the other scene I wanted to talk about, where she gets that new house purchased by Jerry Lee Lewis. And she is on the ground when he comes home trying to cook, and kind of just like you said, a baby doll sit on my butt like a kindergartner. And this is one that should have explored really the stealing of innocence, I would say, because the way the camera is placed there, it's intentional to show the amount of innocence, but it doesn't go anywhere with it other than say, take this, you know, she's 13, and accept it, move on. Nothing to see here, folks, because this is treated as normality. And again, given the time, I don't really care, because this is a betrayal that we see now that it should be taken as a lesson learned from what we've learned from the past. When you have a film that's made now, then there should be something that we take away, a lesson learned. If you make a film about Hitler and you glorify him based on his opinion, that's not accurate. That's not how we saw him. You want to see it exactly how times see him today, to an extent. A horrible example, but that's kind of the way I wanted to see this character portrayed in current times.
I mean, so I feel like if I had to play devil's advocate for what this movie's trying to do, you know, the fact that we get such a realistic performance from both Trey Wilson and Stephen Tobolowsky as the Sun Records guys, it's almost as if, okay, well, maybe we're seeing like a fantastical retelling of this story through their experience, where Jerry Lee Lewis is a handful to manage, and how can they make him rich and famous and popular when he's in the tabloids for all of this? but we don't spend enough time with them to get that idea through. So that's where, like, when I talked about the contradictory flow of this movie, you've got the real realistic characters with real realistic problems, and then you've got these caricatures, these Louisiana foghorn leghorn caricatures of people that aren't believable for a moment. And so it does lose its credibility. Throw in those musical numbers that, like I said, they feel like a Grease or Grease 2 or American Graffiti 50s nostalgia aesthetic, which is a Jim McBride trope. And that's one of the reasons why I think maybe he did make this movie. I mean, Jim McBride and his character of Richard Gere in Breathless essentially is the archetype that all Quentin Tarantino characters are based off of. You know, he dresses up like Elvis and he loves to read comic books and he listens to rockabilly music in his old vehicle. Like, he is got a 50s nostalgia hard on. And we saw that in like the first four Tarantino movies, right? Especially Pulp Fiction. So I can get where the 50s aesthetic that Jim McBride is so obsessed with would feel like it's something very desirable to put on film and make important. But I don't know if it was the producers or the studio that said, hey, you can't make this story the R-rated sultry film that you're normally known for. Instead, we have to make it PG-13 and safe. I mean, you would take your kids to this movie, essentially. And why? Why would you do that?
Well, this setting is aesthetically pleasing on screen, period. So, I mean, if Tom Hanks can do it in That Thing You Do, then, I mean, as a first-time director, I mean, anybody can. But here's where I think we fault with Jim McBride. Is one, he really shows his flaw when it comes to character direction in this, or he's constrained because we even take JW's wife, Lois by Lisa Blount, who her entire screen time is almost seems like placement where she's always seductively looking at, she has this look of always seductively looking at Jerry Lee Lewis. Like, this movie is about a setup of Pornhub. It's like this family is really starting to really be creepy at this point. The character direction is really off when it comes to the look. We even take JW, who finds out about his daughter, 13-year-old daughter, marrying Jerry Lee Lewis, and there's no emotion from him to the point where he just pulls out a gun, says, all right, I'm just going to shoot somebody today. And he just goes on the road and to the station. I mean, there's really nothing to these characters to really give us something. And you spoke to it earlier with Dennis Quaid and Winona Ryder. There is something, if we took anything out of this movie, there is potential of some great performances here. Take the movie can be shitty all at once, but there could still be some good performances and some memorable performances here. But the character direction doesn't give that opportunity. There's nothing here. It's just shoot, action, let's go, cut. And that's where we see it. There's no second looks. The sloppiness of it are these basic looks that we have that really kind of distract from our other characters, that really distract from the dialogue, that distract from the situation that's happening on screen. So these are basic moments in this movie that really does take away. And to an extent, I'm grateful because I didn't want to see the rest of the movie at the second viewing. I wanted to see these details in the background because it's distracting and it's giving me something new to watch. But these are a lot of the flaws that really took it back from when it comes to McBride's direction for me.
Well, and I also think that it's a cheap move to really sell this with almost a MTV music video style where we have to really just kind of forcefully insert these musical numbers and they only play the hits. You know, it's not that Jerry Lee Lewis was a one-hit wonder, but he had like four or five songs that he was really known for, and those are the ones they push, and some of them they play on repeat. Like, in a way, it's like, okay, well, we have to sell the soundtrack, too, and so we have to insert these songs. The musical numbers don't match the energy of the movie after we get past the first 30, 40 minutes. To me, the most interesting part of the movie is when he is on his downward spiral, first in the UK and then in America where no one's showing up and he's just getting drunk on stage and he's smashing his piano and keeps throwing the piano off the stages and stuff when people don't show up. Like, that's what we should have focused on. Instead, we get that in a musical montage and then we go straight to the end And like our critics say, when we'll get to in a second, it doesn't have an end. This movie doesn't have a satisfying end on a positive note or on a negative note. It's like an ellipsis of an ending where it's like, okay, are we going to get another movie or what? And instead, they do the classic 80s thing. We get the subtitles at the end that briefly tells us what happens to these two. And it's like, okay, well, that's the story we should have really gotten, not just this 2-year period that's glamorized by musical numbers and hammy performances.
100% agree. And there is a scene in the beginning that I actually did enjoy. And I really wish they would have slingshotted from this to really show the grittiness and really show a true picture, which is when he's singing Great Balls of Fire at the bar for the first time. And you see that bar grittiness, and then you see kind of the sexual nature of him commanding this girl to dance and in a sexual way. They should have really slingshotted from that to really show a different perspective on that. Because this movie, you take a couple scenes out of it and it's very sexualized because it's so out of place and out of context that it really doesn't make sense. But I think if they would have taken it from the beginning and go to and added in exactly what you said, the rise and fall, but showed the disgusting behavior, this could have been a decent movie. This would have been a more unique movie. This would have been an honest movie. And then you take it and you take it through the perspective of Mira.
Okay, so while we're on that subject, that girl with no lines and just that performance of her dancing and getting the rest of the bar into it, that was the MVP moment of the movie for me. That was my favorite performance. It was like, okay, I want to watch a movie about that girl. I am tired of everyone else. Like, she was my favorite part of the movie. And you're 100% right. One of the things that I think I can slightly respect the movie for doing is not going too far down the rabbit hole of, oh, white rock and roll recording artists of the 50s shamelessly stole black blues and R&B music. We've seen that story played enough. They give us just enough, and then just enough of like the racial stereotypes from the record producers, like they do in Walk the Line, you know, like, okay, you're singing black music and now we're going to turn it into rock and roll and make a bunch of money. We've heard that story over and over again. I'm glad they don't spend too much time on it. But shit, man, maybe that would have helped. Maybe that would have helped this movie to get us off of the subject matter that it chooses to focus on. Like, I'm going to go back in a circle again. This did not have to be made. Like, this did not have to be a movie because there's no redeeming qualities to it. And there's no qualities to it that make us feel so angry at this character at the end that we leave the theater thinking about it and fuming on it. If anything, we're just happy that it's over. At least that's the point of view that I had.
This is the ending that I would actually boo at, because this guy is so unlikable with everything that he's done that if you're cheering at a happy ending for everything this guy has done, there's something wrong with you.
There's something wrong with you.
God.
I think that we've spent 28 minutes talking about how much this movie disappointed us. I think the difference is I knew I was going to be disappointed. I was ready. I even went and spent $5 on the DVD because this thing's not streaming anywhere. It's not even on YouTube, so that wasn't a good sign for me. If you can't find it streaming, it's either a really, really, really good, important movie that people are trying to monetize, or it's a really shitty movie that people just want to bury, and I think that's where it lies, in my opinion. But let's hear what our critics say. This was Roger's episode to bring and introduce.
There's good music in this movie, all of it performed on the soundtrack by Jerry Lee Lewis himself. In fact, the credits at the end say, all vocals and piano by the killer himself. I enjoyed also in this movie the cocky way that Dennis Quaid played the killer, but Great Balls of Fire takes a biographical approach that could best be described as once over, very, very lightly. I never had any idea during this movie what Jerry Lee Lewis was really thinking, and I don't think the movie wanted me to.
He nailed it right on the head with that. The movie doesn't want you to know what he's thinking because what he's thinking is disgusting. They're just going to tiptoe around the premise of like, well, he's in love with this girl. I don't buy it.
typically in a movie like this, we would want to know what's inside the artist. We want to know exactly what happened behind the curtain. But this is a movie that he's right. I don't want to know what he's thinking at this point. But at the same time, I would like to know what all the other characters are thinking. I would like to know what public opinion is other than just having clips of news recordings or newspaper clippings. So there is a lot here that there's ways to make it work. But here it instead just, again, sanitizes it and it glorifies it. So he nails it on this one because this movie almost becomes almost like a cartoon where it just plays like a commercial or publicity stunt for Jerry Lee Lewis.
This is a film that takes a life that has been mired in drugs, alcohol, violence, and tragedy and tries to find one little period of a couple of years that were sort of like the cliches of Hollywood musical biographies. And even then, the life is pretty seamy and depressing. Jerry Lee Lewis comes across in this movie as popularized, sanitized, and almost lobotomized. And even then, he seems to belong in a tragedy, not a musical comedy.
So it's kind of exactly what we talked about in the beginning. So it really glorifies a lot of the actions from this character. And to me, it's almost a disservice of Ebert, even though I agree with him, that he doesn't go deeper with this on more specific examples. Because there is a lot to this movie to really show almost a distrust from the filmmakers on what they're seeing on screen. This is a type of movie that I would expect Ebert to just really tear apart more than what he actually did here, because it's almost insulting to the audience that it's propaganda for a character. And this is a topic that Ebert is very passionate about when it comes to filmmaking. And this is the pivotal example of propaganda that demonstrates what we see or how we portray a character. Because honestly, if you take, like I said, I was fooled by this character at 7-8 years old, and that's going to be a popular name to a kid. So if you say Jerry Lee Lewis, I listened to Jerry Lee Lewis going all the way up into my late teens, and I still do. But it's because I didn't understand why. I remember the happy ending. I remember the music. And that is kind of, to me, a disservice. It's distrust coming from what they're showing kids. And if this was marketed as almost a teetering family movie.
That's, yeah, it kind of was.
Yeah, it's kind of disgusting because as an adult, when I go to rewatch it for the first time, I'm like, holy shit, that is gross.
Well, and it's funny because like he compliments Quaid's energy behind the performance, but at the same time, he is very skeptical about what that performance actually means to the subject matter of the movie. And he calls it very cliche. He's like, this is just another cliche music biopic. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, you could have done a really, really dark and dramatic telling of this story. And you can still have the music, but you don't have to sanitize it so much. That's why, like, I think there maybe was some kind of studio interference or like an interference with the estate. I mean, maybe they just wanted that Jerry Lee Lewis music so bad that they're like, okay, well, we can't totally rip this guy apart. Otherwise he won't sing on the soundtrack. Right. We got to make it seem like his heart was in the right place. I have the same problem with Walk the Line where we do see a lot of the depravity, right, that Johnny Cash goes through. And we do see that temptation of wealth and of excess that someone who comes from nothing can be so drawn to. And they really do it with this, except I think they feel it more with Ego than they do with drugs and women and stuff like that. He can get women anyway. He could get women when he was poor. The real story there is like he wanted something that no one else could have, and that's this 13-year-old girl, and that's the ego part of it. But instead, they show us the ego of, I'm going to be the biggest star. All the women are going to love me. I'm going to have the fanciest car, and I'm going to be better than Elvis. That's his goal, is to be better than Elvis, to the point where he won't even shake Elvis's hand or meet him when he visits the record store. That's what we should have seen a lot more of. And instead, we get, like he said, the sanitized high-energy glamour. So I agree with you where he should have, could have, ripped into this more, and he kind of does. They fight in a second, but I think that he was just really impressed with Dennis Quaid's performance. Don't ask me why, but I can see that he's having a hard time defending the movie because of Jerry Lee Lewis's persona as portrayed by Quaid, without tearing apart the stuff that we've been tearing apart for the last 30 minutes.
Yeah, and I'll go on defense on Dennis Quaid again, even though, again, I agree with you on everything that you said. But as you were talking, I'm thinking how hard of a portrayal this must have been, especially if maybe not you didn't see the entire script or you don't know how this portrayal can go, because the filmmakers don't even know how this movie's going to go. So Right. You have the dramatic piece of it that there has to be a certain level of uncomfort on what you're trying to do, which is portray a love for a 13-year-old girl. To me, you can kind of see the struggle. And again, without assuming, that would just be me. If I were to play that role, it would be a level of uncomfort for a young Dennis Quaid to portray. So I think he, given the material, he does okay. But again, I do see a lot of flaws in the performance, with the exception going into the dramatic piece of it. But if I were to kind of defend him at some aspect, it would be that.
I agree. That's an interesting take on it.
The film communicated that much to you. It cannot be all sunshine and light. I mean, if you
not see, in his life.
No. I mean, in the movie, did I like the film except for the ending, which I understand, reading press accounts, that was tacked on at the end, a more upbeat kind of ending. I think they ran out of gas. They show the two qualities that make him distinctive. Certainly the music above and beyond everything, and then this marriage to the second cousin twice removed, as she says.
I'm really surprised that actually Gene likes this film, because we've seen him tear apart films like this that are better than this. But he does make some good comments in the sense of like, okay, so what's up with that ending? This happy ending that just tacked on, where they bring Alec Baldwin's Jimmy Swaggart back, who's getting her to testify that she's a sinner, and he's trying to get Jerry Lee to testify too. And he's like, you know what? Jesus can kiss my ass. And he leaves and she follows. It doesn't have any credibility to it, other than the fact that we don't want to see the down ending of, oh, he probably kept on beating her. He probably kept on emotionally abusing her. And instead, we get them driving off into the sunset to Jerry Lee Lewis music, and we're left confused of like, well, what redemption was there? What character arcs were there? This just feels like they gave up. And that's what I think he means when it says it runs out of gas.
Gene must have been in a great movie mood this weekend, because to me, he was fooled by this movie, just like my young self was. Is we hear time and time again from Gene that he cannot stand kids in peril. He thinks it's cheap. He thinks it's trashy. Then when we have a real right. life story, and the elements are there of a 13-year-old that's in peril, a pregnant 13-year-old.
She's a kid in peril.
Who's being beaten. And it's an entertaining film. So this is where there's a huge contradiction, because we take this autobiography of Jerry Lee Lewis that actually happened from the words of his ex-wife, and that's not peril of a kid. So to me, that's the frustrating piece of it. I get there are elements that are entertaining. I'm not going to argue that. To me, there was. But when it comes to this being a good film, there's no aspect that it's unorganized. It's, again, by the soundtrack, if you found that the most entertaining of it, because that's the only yeah. thing you're going to take from this film that's really going to be the toe-tapping piece of it, because everything in this movie is exactly what Roger said. There is nothing here that Gene says that is accurate, and it contradicts a lot of reviews that he's done in the past.
Well, and that's one of the things that, too, maybe I've just been too spoiled. Maybe we as cinema goers have been too spoiled in the last 20 years since Walk the Line came out, where actors are actually going to act. They're actually going to put in the work and perform these songs. Joaquin Phoenix did it. Jamie Foxx did it. We had the Freddie Mercury movie where Rami Malek did it, and even the Elton John movie. You cannot be in a musical biopic anymore and not perform the songs. So even though I do love the film La Bamba and it's a music biopic, I think that's more of the energy that I love of that movie, less just, you know, the stereotypical musical biopic. But Dennis Quaid doesn't have to do a lot here. He can just lip sync, raise his eyebrows, and hop on the piano, right? to me, it's not an impressive performance. It's not anything special, especially by today's standards. So maybe back then it was. But then at the same time, it's like, oh, we had Buddy Holly's story too, and that one was pretty damn good too. It's just, I can't understand. I know they both have issues with the film, but why do they have so much admiration for Dennis Quaid's performance in this? It blows my mind.
It's, I can tell you right now, it's his on-screen presence, not his performance, because his on-screen presence, he's a likable guy on screen. And even though, dude, open for interpretation, opinion. So to me, to this day, I think the character was completely off base, but I do think Dennis Quaid, he's a pleasant guy in early Dennis Quaid to really watch on screen. There is a certain level of energy, even though I didn't like the performance. So energy can be easily mistaken for great performance.
Yeah, this is true.
So, and you add the element of the supporting cast. That's the importance of the supporting cast, is to amplify the main character. So it does have a solid supporting cast to it, with the exception of a couple characters that I already mentioned. But to me, the Dennis Quaid character, it's, again, I said it earlier, it's a cartoon. It's, he's cartoonish. And when you see something that's energetic and fancy on screen, that's chewing bubblegum 99% of the time on screen, that's what gets your attention. But I think when it comes to his portrayal of it, I think it was a good movie mood for Gene, because honestly, I think this is one of those movies that if you go in at the exact right time and you're in a great mood, you're going to see more positives than negatives, and you're going to ignore everything. It's a hypnotic trance that music and musical numbers do to a lot of filmgoers. And here's, I've said this a lot, when we take to Priscilla, and I said it earlier, is there, it's brilliantly executed with the amount of music in it, and Priscilla has nothing to lose when it comes to telling the story, and you see the grittiness from her point of view. There is no energy to that movie whatsoever. It's raw. But here, we have to have energy because it matches the music. You cannot contradict each other, because that's where the filmmakers are going to say it's going to look confusing to families. It's going to have audiences turn away from it. And that's where it's really going to amplify a lot of the pieces to it, where you don't know what kind of audience you're going to have. But in the turn, we still don't know what this movie, who this movie was made for.
Now they spar a little bit, which is really, really fun. I forgot how much they sparred on this particular episode.
After that, they don't have any place to go in this story. I like, though, however, tremendously, the way the music is performed and the way that the cutting is done by the editor working with director Jim McBride. Let the songs go on. I mean, this is a little innovation. Let the songs go on and then cut, advance the story through the songs. It's a way of doing a different kind of movie musical, which I enjoyed. It's very refreshing.
The musical themes are entertaining in this movie, but if you start out with those songs by Jerry Lee Lewis, how could they not be? And you're right about the editing, and you're right about the imagination there. But who, and you're also right, or you would have been right if you'd said so, that Dennis Quaid does a good job
of
looking like and convincing us as Jerry Lee Lewis. But what was this man thinking? What is the real Jerry Lee like?
Gene starts off with how much he likes the music video aesthetic of this movie, of how I love how they just edit the movie to the music and then let the music go on like a music video. We've covered three movies so far on this podcast where he hated how this movie was trying to be a music video, or how the director was using his music video director's skills and ideas and energy and applying it to a feature film. And here he is saying, I loved how they did this. And Roger agrees, but at the same time, he's like, that doesn't cover up the fact of the story of what is this man thinking? How are we supposed to identify with this guy, no matter how fun his performance is, that he is marrying and essentially abusing physically and emotionally a 13-year-old girl? Like, Roger's got it. He has got it. Like, this movie doesn't work, no matter how glossy it tries to be, and Gene's still trying to be complimentary about how he likes the gloss and how he likes the energy and the music. And they spar over that. And I feel like there's so many more things that they should be sparring about than that.
100%, because, I mean, this movie did have a ton of music videos that came out following this movie to market it. And again, we look at the music of it when it actually transitions. I mean, he's really trying. And I love the fact when Gene goes, "What's the point?" Or "What's the point?
What's the point?"
I mean, Roger has valid points, but the only thing Gene's pulling from this movie is the music, which screams, you know what?
Yes.
You know what you are, Gene? It is a fan of Jerry Lee Lewis. That's what it is, because you really want to like this movie. You love the music. You love the man. And when you find somebody that you really like, you want to find every reason to really be engulfed into that movie that you sat through an hour and 40 minutes of just his pure music that you get a visual for. Because without this movie, you wouldn't have had the music videos. You wouldn't have the visual spectacle that you did from when the music first came out. So this was almost nostalgic, I'm sure, for him to really experience the visuals of Great Balls of Fire and all the Jerry Lee Lewis's music that is on the big screen. Because that is me assuming, because there is nothing here of substance that he's actually delivering of why this movie is good.
Well, he did the same thing with Saturday Night Fever. It was like his favorite movie, right? But Tony Manero was like one of the worst characters ever to hit the screen in both films that he was in. It's like, it's Staying Alive. He is literally the worst guy ever. And Gene kind of idolized him. And I think it's because he liked the Bee Gees and the disco music so much. I like Saturday Night Fever. I like it a lot, but it's not a redeeming movie. There's no like redemption for it, other than the fact that, you know, okay, well, I get to go pursue my dream to be a dancer in Broadway, blah, blah, blah. I feel he's doing the same thing here. He is using that hero worship of the music and the charm and the mystique of a performer and letting it cloud his judgment of like, okay, this movie doesn't really cover the things that we want to know about this guy on a deeper level. I mean, we don't want to know about them, but we don't want to watch a movie where it just covers it up. You know, it's like we came for the music and we came for the dirt, and the dirt isn't dirty enough.
Yeah, and honestly, if they made a movie and they were serious about it and they had a lesson learned of what's wrong with it without glorifying it, that is a piece of art that would have been interesting to me. But here, everything is glorified. And with this review, I think out of everything we have on the list right now with films, this is going to be the review that really bugs me about Gene, that he can't see through this, that he can't see the faults. Because to me, that, again, I can see a child like in this movie, like I said, for the music, but not an adult, one especially with kids, that really has a problem and really analyzes horror movies or action movies with kids in peril. But you can't get past that in a movie that plays fancy music, has a bright and sunny scene, and has all these almost traumatic things that doesn't happen to necessarily the girl till the end, but the family has to be going through the traumatic. There's a lot of elements to this that, again, Gene was tricked in this movie on how he perceived it.
Yeah, agreed. He gets an F for me. Like, I did not like a single thing that he brought to this movie. Critique. I don't like any of the points that he tried to debate with when Roger starts pulling facts and starts pulling some genuine concerns about the movie. And that is where your consistency and your message really matters, is that the way that he does contradict himself in his messaging, depending on how he liked the movie, maybe not even the movie, how the movie made him feel. Was it the music or the character or something that he liked? Go back to the whole Lucas debate they had, you know, in our best of episode. It's one of those things where at least Roger's more consistent with his message and he remembers more of the critiques that he's given, and he can have that memory call back to the point. It's like, okay, well, I made this point on this movie before, so even if I'm going to contradict myself, I'm going to allude my previous comment so at least people know that I am recognizing what I said. Where I feel Gene so frequently just puts a blind eye to things he said in the past and then just says some bullshit like he does.
Yeah, and Roger in his written review has a little bit more detail to it, and I think he does, for being part of Disney at this point, there are certain things he can and can't say on TV. And I get it. I get it. But I think he nails all the Reader's Digest bullet points of this, where he really just nails the points of it being sanitized. And that, I think, would be the perfect word to describe the entire movie. Me, it would be biased and it would be propaganda if I were to pick a couple words when it comes to glorifying somebody that was absolutely disgusting in the stuff that he does in this movie. But to me, I think Roger, for me, is going to get a solid 3 stars when it comes to the way he presented it on just a pure understanding. And again, in the 80s, and them growing up in that time frame, it could have been a mix of both of them being used to that kind of behavior, I want to say, or that being, but or constraint on the studio. But at the same time, if we took contemporary critics today and showed that for the first time, I guarantee you a majority of critics would have pinpointed a lot of the things that we are saying right now.
And audiences, too. Like, I got into Amazon and IMDb just to see what people's modern contemporary critiques of this movie are, and they're not good. You know, it still sits in between like a 5 and a 6 on IMDb, but if you read the reviews, people are saying the same thing we are. Like, they're saying, okay, well, yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis music is great, but this guy was terrible. Why did we make a movie about it? And why is Dennis Quaid always raising his eyebrows and just really having this high energy comical performance in moments where he's supposed to be dramatic? Like, he's just always on. He can't turn it off even for a second. And something tells me, and we saw in Priscilla, where the persona of the megastar, even when they start becoming that person in their everyday life, where the ego and the glamour has now possessed them in their everyday life when audience members aren't around, there is a sense of despair and there is a sense of, let's say, emotional trauma in themselves, where they're losing touch with their identity and becoming this persona that they've created. This doesn't do that. He's just always this way. Before he was famous, after he was famous, this is just his character, and I don't buy it.
100%. And would I love to see a Jerry Lee Lewis movie today? Absolutely. I would love to see how this would be treated today in the context of where we're at today. And again, since he passed in 2022, I think it would be a great opportunity to really tell the story, to almost make up for the crap that we got here.
Right. I mean, give it to someone who is daring enough to tackle subjects like this. Like, give it to Todd Solondz, right? Give it to someone who can make movies that will show us what the underbelly of being an adult with very, very bad decision making can really do. And now make him famous, and now make him a movie star, and make him a rock and roll star. That's what I would want to see, just because that will at least be interesting and it doesn't feel like I'm being sold a lie.
Totally agree. And again, this is probably one that we're never going to see for years down the road, because I think this one might have actually ruined it.
I don't even want this anymore.
You're welcome.
Oh, boy. I'm glad. Like, I was dreading this moment, but I'm glad we had it, because sometimes I feel like I'll be wrong, right? Sometimes I'll think, like, well, maybe I've been too hard on a movie. Maybe I've been too hard on a performer, and I feel justified in this one. And I'm not rubbing your nose like, you had love for this movie and now you recognize that you don't. I feel more justified the fact that, like, okay, well, I trust your judgment pretty much more than anybody, because maybe it was me. Like, maybe I'm just the one who's like, ah, shit, this is a movie that everyone else likes and I don't. No, I feel better about it because it's not a good movie.
Well, you had, I don't want to call it the benefit, but you got to see it when you were more mature. And I think a lot of people that really went into this movie at the time that you were a teenager, it didn't age well. With me, this thing played on TV all the time in the early 90s, late 80s. And it's something that really did. I saw it in the theater. So this was, to me, a family event. And the sex scene was extremely awkward, where I had the hand over my eyes. But But the more mature you are when you witness this movie, the more you're going to realize what absolute trash it really is.
Okay, so now onto something a little more high art, a little bit more glamorous. Our movie next week is going to be a suggestion from one of our listeners. It's going to be Godzilla 1985 from our friend Mikey, who watches and follows us on YouTube. That'll be our next episode, which I can honestly say I've never seen. So I'm really excited to see it.
Oh, this is going to be a good conversation.
And great recommendation. I watched the review, though.
But it was a great recommendation because I teetered around this one for a while. So I'm glad somebody brought it to the table.
Yeah, see, I didn't. It would have never come from my end. So, yeah, that'll be next week, Godzilla 1985. In the meantime, please like, rate, review, share, subscribe to our show on YouTube, on your favorite listening platform. Don't forget to subscribe to my show, The Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast, and Justin's show, The Movie Wire. You can find us at thecultworthy.com.
And themoviewire.com.
And just like our friend Mikey, don't be afraid to send in suggestions of a film that Siskel and Ebert reviewed on their show. We would love to put it on our list because I feel like we are now in that spot where we're playing poker. Like, I'm throwing movies on the list that I think that you haven't seen, or maybe you have like a disposition for, and I know you're doing the same thing to me. We need some people's influence to kind of keep us from keep playing poker.
Otherwise, we are going to put Weekend at Bernie's on the list.
I'm going to put it on there right now. I'm going to put Weekend at Bernie's 2.
Which is a better sequel.
Agreed. All right. Everyone, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.